Hello, I'm Mary Brett, the resident doer of things. Thank you for being here. At the Doers of Things, we intend to share conversations with you that demystify the creative process and humanize the journey, which are just fancy ways of saying we hope you get inspired to go out and do the things that bring you joy after hearing a fellow human share how and why they do what they do. We are all innate creators curating our reality with every thought, word, and action. My guests all have different stories, backgrounds, and passions, but the one thing they hold in common is that they do the things that nurture the reality they want to live. They all just started somewhere and kept doing. Today, we're going to share a conversation had with highly acclaimed and renowned photographer Michael Weintraub. But first, I want to let you know that this is a value for value, pay what you wish, give what you can, free will investment model listening experience. That means you get to choose what you contribute in time, talent, or treasure to reflect the amount of value you get from listening to the Doers of Things. No donation is too small, and all donations help produce the show. Head over to thedoersofthings.com to learn more in the Donate tab. The conversation you're about to hear would not have happened if it weren't for last week's guest, Ellie Sanders. Before she and I sat down to chat, April of 2023, she mentioned how Michael Weintraub is a real doer and be good for the show. Before I made it back home after our chat on her porch, I had a text that she had reached out to Weintraub and he was down for a conversation. That's what I'm talking about with the mindset of doers. They don't wait, they just do. She immediately sent the text, he immediately said yes to the opportunity. Make sure you listen to episode 10 with Ellie Sanders to fully appreciate her doerness, and keep listening now to learn about his. I met Michael Weintraub at his studio in Nashville, less than 12 hours from being introduced, bright and early with kolaches in hand. A giant portrait of Valerie June was coming off the printer in preparation for the event back in 2023 you'll hear him talk about. I helped him set up a stand that was delivered during our chat for the event, and after it was all said and done, he let me bang on his drum kit for S's and G's and sent me home with a parting gift of his portrait of Big Chief Donald Harrison. Here's my chat with doer Michael Weintraub.
I'm like one of the last generations of photographers to shoot film as a profession.
Okay.
And you had to before everything went digital.
Okay. Know? Do you miss that? Do you miss shooting film?
No.
No, not at all.
Not even a little bit. I'll be honest with you. I miss like going to the lab and looking at the photos. But yeah, no. No, I don't. I don't miss it.
What about that experience are you fine with letting go of?
I like the ability to see the images that you're creating in the moment to where you're able to, if you're not getting what you're looking for, you're able to change that and figure out how to problem solve in the moment to capture what you're trying to create.
That makes sense. Yeah. So you started off doing live performances, being the house photographer for some pretty remarkable venues like Red Rocks and Newport Folk Jazz and...
Yeah, so I started off, I was in college at Colorado State University, and I was became the house photographer for the Aggie Theater, and I was always into music, and I was shooting concerts on, you know, on a nightly basis in town, and I had to come up with an idea for a business in my class in college, a fake business, which was called Groovetography.
Okay.
Which was, you know, probably the worst name in the history of business. But, I don't like to give up, so I kept it for about 7 years, even after I graduated, and then I ran into a musician in New Orleans that called me the Groovetographer, and I was like, okay, it's time to use my own name.
Okay, yeah. What made you want to shift from doing the live work, which you had some of the, you know, best in the business type stuff coming out, to shift into doing portrait work?
Well, I still do it, and I never really stopped doing it, but when I moved to New York City, I moved to New York in 2003. Someone offered me a place to live, and I agreed to live there without ever even seeing it, and packed up my car and drove cross country to Brooklyn. Never even been to Brooklyn. Never even saw the place I was going to move into. Kind of very similar to your type story, and I moved into this place, and I met with all these editors at, you know, George Pitts at Vibe magazine and Maria Tobias at Time magazine and Jennifer Santana at Rolling Stone. And, you know, I'd worked with some of these people servicing some of my live music photography in the past. Like, I'd shot Bonnaroo for Rolling Stone for a long time on spec, where I'd go and shoot the concerts and they'd run my photographs. But I met with these editors, showed them my work, and said, I want to be a portrait photographer because, you know, that's obviously the evolution to being a professional photographer, okay. shooting portraits. And they all told me that my live music stuff and event photography was as good as it gets. But if I wanted to be a portrait photographer in New York City, I needed to do some studying.
Yeah. So in 2000 was the first time that you took a picture with somebody's face covered with their instrument, the bass player of Derek Trucks.
That's right.
And then in 2008, I believe it was, after you've done it for a while, you come across this inspiration of this book right here, which you can tell that, you know, you've thumbed through it a few times, of the disciples, of the fans being dressed like the people that they're fans of, and realizing that you had something special with what you were doing to make your voice. Was there any other thing that you were doing, or was that just a clear moment of clarity that, like, I need to go into this?
I was always trying to do these creative projects. You know, every year I would get hired to photograph something called the Jam Cruise, which is a music festival on a cruise ship. And, you know, in 2006, I believe, I set up a portrait studio, which was a very simple studio, where I shot portraits of musicians. And then I thought to myself, wow, this is just, you know, copying Irving Penn or Danny Clinch or one of these guys. How can I tell the story? So the next year, I came back on Jam Cruise, and the year after, and we figured out that we wanted to dress the musicians as crew members or cruisers. So, you know, things like Warren Haynes is the captain, or Colonel Bruce Hampton is the bartender, or Grace Potter is the maid, or Carl Denson is the chef, or Al from Moe as the dishwasher, or Michael Franti doing yoga on the crew, things like that.
Yeah.
And so I was always trying to work on these creative projects because, you know, I went back to telling you about doing studying. I'd moved into a building in Brooklyn that was filled with all these assistants of famous photographers like Mark Seliger and Annie Leibovitz. They taught me how to do portrait photography. So I kept trying to hone my portrait craft. And then I stopped doing that particular art project I was working on. And that's when I wandered into the bookstore and found that book, The Disciples, and thought, this was so cool, the guessing game that's been created with this book, with the fans, because all the fans looked like the people, like you just said. I thought, how can I do that with the musicians? Oh, I already have these images of them with their instruments over their heads, and so how can I tell their story? And, you know, and that's where it all, I started focusing on that at that moment.
You know. Have you, you know, met and reached out to the photographer of this book, The Disciples? Are y'all buds?
We are not buds. I have reached out through his website before, and he never responded. I'm not sure if he ever saw the email or the message, but I did, you know, talk about him in the intro to my first book. And, you know, it's a real inspiration what he did, and, you know, it inspired me to be able to expand on what I had already been creating that I didn't know that I was creating.
Right. So when you came out with Instrument Head in 2017, is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. You kind of did it a little bit backwards in the sense that you had an exhibit of your work before you had a book ready. And that was part of your crowdfunding operation to be able to get the book published.
That's right.
Yeah. Would you have ever taken that back? Would you have liked to have had the book first, or did you think that was just a great way to do
it? I wouldn't take anything back. Everything that's happened is what was meant to happen. And yeah, I've done everything backwards. There's no formulaic approach to anything that I've done. I've just trusted my instincts along the way and learned a lot of hard lessons, and somehow has led me to where we are today.
What are some of the lessons you learned in the crowdfunding game?
Well, you know, in today's day and age, you know, I had met with, basically the long story short is I never showed anyone these images because I was afraid of people stealing my idea.
Okay.
I showed people in the business and the managers and the people like that. And then someone had contacted me saying, hey, wonderful image in Mojo magazine. It was a portrait of a famous electronic musician with his instrument covering his face, but it looked just like my photography, but it wasn't me who took it. So I started, you know, calling lawyers and doing all this and doing all, and then I realized I need to have a show and I need to have a big one.
Yeah.
And that's what happened in New Orleans, where we had 75 4-foot tall photographs that you can learn about in the intro of the first book, where I tell the whole story from start to finish, how we almost destroyed the 75 photographs twice in a 24-hour period.
Ah.
But, you know, it all worked out and over 7,000 people came. And when I went to do the crowdfund, you know, I had already, like, I go back, I met with original publishers at HarperCollins and Rizzoli and Time Warner, and none of them knew what to do with my book and how it would be marketed, and they're promising me if I buy 5,000 books, they can, you know, things like
that's
that,
big,
and, you know, buybacks. I'm like, how can I do 5,000 books? And then I thought, well, I have a lot of relationships with people that I've met throughout, you know, my journeys as a photographer. And I decided to do the crowdfund, and in 30 days, I raised enough money to do the book, where I actually had to go out and raise more money because I was working with folks that did not have the same vision as me, and I had to pull my project back to myself and find the right people to help me to do it. But the crowdfund, the pre-order in today's digital age is really wonderful because your community can support your work, mm-hmm. you know, and it's not like you're saying, hey, let me have a loan to put this thing out. You know, for me, I'm offering books and fine art photography, prints and photo shoots, and you're actually just selling your services up front, you know, and as long as you deliver what you tell people you're offering them that they bought into, that's what makes crowdfunding great. And then your community can empower you to be able to do your thing, and then you have something to sell.
Yeah.
And if you're a maker or a doer, like you would say, and you use your hands to create, well, what happens when your hands break?
Right.
And you can't create anymore. You know, you got to have something to sell in this world that's something greater than yourself, I believe. And that's what these books and my artwork have empowered me to do.
It's really special what you're doing because I've heard you mention before that typically a photo shoot is going to have a bunch of styling done, you know, be it makeup artists and putting you in clothes that aren't something you'd normally wear, but just to have a shock value in a photo. But what you've done is allow them to bring themselves to the session. Their personal items, the personal clothes that they would like to wear, because you're trying to make something very personable. Because you're doing this guessing game, you know, so you need it to be as revealing while still, like, hiding who they are. In these moments, have you had anyone get emotional about getting to see themselves instead of what their stylist thought they should look like? And you don't have to say names if that's...
I don't believe in that way people become emotional. I believe that photography is about sharing space with people and breaking down, you know, the barrier, you know, that the walls that people put up. And, you know, everyone has the ability to be cool and everyone has the ability to be a kid again. So, my goal as a photographer when I'm sharing space with people is to bring that out in people. So I have had people become emotional in these photo shoots because of the walls that were broken down and they felt comfortable enough to be themselves in these photo shoots. But most of the time, you know, people like the photographs of them if they like themselves or they like the way that they look in general, because they are wearing their clothes and have their props and things that, you know, mean a lot to them in these shoots, which makes them feel comfortable, which in turn can make a good image.
What are some of the things that you do to try to produce that comfortability and that trust between them? Is that just an energy that you carry and it just happens like that? Or do y'all sit down and talk beforehand? Like, what do you do to help?
Well, you tell me. We've been sitting here talking for about a half hour and you seem to feel pretty comfortable and have told me a lot of things about your life. So it's just what we've done in the last half hour of, you know, meeting. You know, it's just making people feel comfortable. Many situations, I start these photo shoots out where I get the musicians to perform for me.
Oh, neat.
Because they're not models.
Right.
They're musicians. They're performers. So when does an introvert or an extrovert or a performer feel their best when they're performing. They're doing their thing, you know, and, you know, their true selves come out. So I get people to play a few songs for me, do their thing, and then afterwards they're more comfortable, you know.
I can see that.
People worry so much about the photo shoot, how they're going to look and everything like that. But for me, it's to just kind of try to, you know, pull out my shine box and the old, what do they say, dog and pony show or whatever, just to try to get, you know, people to laugh and be themselves. And, you know, hopefully that comes out in the photography.
I think that it does. I think that I mean, especially when you get into the second book, The Revealed, that was 2022. So that came out. So that was just last year.
Yeah, it came out a year ago on April 24th. Will be a year that it's been out.
Oh, that's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
So you're coming up on your 1 year anniversary. Are you going to do anything fun to celebrate that?
Oh, in a huge way. I'm going to New Orleans, and I'm doing an 11-day exhibition in the Virgin Hotel at Jazz Fest. From April the 28th is our opening night. May 7th is our closing night. We'll have live music every night. We'll have around 44-foot-tall photographs. This is the 10-year anniversary of the first show I told you about in New Orleans, where
okay.
we almost destroyed all the pictures. And the cool thing about this show is that I'll be showing the revealed images and the instrument heads side by side. And it's a benefit for the New Orleans Musicians Clinic, whom I've been working with for probably 15 years and raised quite a bit of money for them on my own. And it's their 25-year anniversary. And Bethany Boltman, who's the head of the clinic, actually wrote the foreword to the new book coming out of the pandemic. And it's not called a foreword. It's called A Step Forward.
Oh, I like
so
that.
So it's kind of talking about where we're at with the pandemic. And, you know, I'm just really proud that I'm doing this exhibit and I'm able to show this work. And I'm going to reprint with, you know, the box sets right now in Italy are doing it again. And it's just really exciting to just, you know, educate people, continue to educate people whom these musicians are, who I've grown to love over the years and have been, you know, the soundtrack and the movie of my life, basically, you know.
Yeah. So you've got several other philanthropy things that you do, and a lot of them surround around the mental health of musicians. Why do you think that that is such a sticky issue with all sorts of high-level creators?
I mean, I believe that I like to be tied to different organizations that help people, especially in music, because that's the space that I've always been in. And the New Orleans Musicians Clinic is a great one because they have a clinic, like an actual health clinic that helps people, but then they're, you know, trying to help, you know, just like Backline is with, you know, mental illness in the music business. They are also trying to help with that. I think it's really important to, you know, artists have demons. Everyone has demons, and I want to support someone who helps people with their problems, because I've had a lot of problems in my life and I probably still have a lot of problems, and I'm just trying to, we're all here just living in this world and, you know, trying to do our best, and I want to use my artwork to support people who are supporting people.
That's a pretty noble thing to go after, for sure.
Thanks.
What are some of the things that you've used to keep yourself, You asked me, like, how is it that I'm comfortable with you? You definitely have a comfortable energy. You don't have a chaotic energy, you know.
Sometimes I do.
I'm sure we all have our moments, you know. But
on 2 days before this show's up in New Orleans when I'm on the floor crying. No, I'm just kidding.
What are some of the things that you kind of cling to help keep yourself centered and grounded, so that you can be that for people to feel comfortable around?
My family. You know, my wife is a very grounding force in my life. I'm a new dad, so I have a 2-year-old daughter, and you know, all these things we've been doing kind of means a lot more to me.
Yeah. You're building a legacy more than ever now.
A legacy, or, you know, at first I always wanted to prove something to my family, my
okay.
parents, that, you know, I was going to be a great rock and roll photographer. And, you know, and now with all the accolades and different things that and experiences I've had in my life, I feel at peace with my experiences. Now I just want to kind of educate people and help other photographers and other content creators and show them that, you know, they can accomplish their dreams. It takes a lot of work.
Yeah.
And you can monetize your work. It takes a lot of energy. But I want to just help people and not, you know, they say, do you get to the top standing on people's shoulders or on their graves? You know, I'd rather be boosted up by people and boost them up with me as things happen.
What are some of the ways that being a dad has changed your eye as a photographer or the way that you even move about the world?
Time management is for one. I never knew what I did with all my time before. I mean, I look at these books and all these photographs I shot, and I can't even believe I did it and had the time to do it. And, you know, and it's funny, these books have, because everything is pre-2016 and before, so I still have another 400 people that no one has ever seen before that'll be in the next.
That was about to ask that, you know, this came out, but you still have more. So
I still have another 400
people
that I worked on the instrument at. It'll be the third incarnation of this project with another book eventually. I'll put out other books of my rock and roll photography. I just try to trust my inner voice, you know, and when I start to take on too much and I start to get frantic, I am able to let it go. Like, for instance, I was trying to book all the bands for this New Orleans show, and I was, you know, I'm not used to having support. I have a lot of support on this show, but I go into autopilot. So I caught myself the other day saying, I don't really need to do what I'm doing here. I'm making myself stressed for no reason. And I let it go and I gave it away to someone else, and they're doing a good job at it. So for me, it's noticing when my controlling nature to try to control everything takes over, and knowing when it's time to let something go. And I think by being a parent, to go back to your original question, I've learned what's more important, like with my daughter and, like, you know, tantrums and things like that, like how to let things roll off and how to, you know, try to be present in the moment and actually listen to my what's going on and not trip out about the things I can't control.
Yeah.
And
do you have people? Yeah, totally. I mean, control issues is a big deal. I think acceptance is one of our biggest lessons here to learn, you know, of like accepting what is actually in your power. Even most of the time what's happening is just your preference isn't being met, but that doesn't mean that anything bad is actually happening to you, you know, and to just go with the flow of that understanding that everything's got a lesson and a blessing in there.
Well, as long as you know that you're, I think we're all, you know, our goal, my goal is to do the best with the tools I have. And I'm conscious that I don't have a chest with all the tools in it. You know, there's certain things I'm good at and there's certain things I'm not. And then hopefully the things I'm not good at, I can empower other people to help me who are good at those things. And then you create a strong team.
Yeah. Who are some of the people throughout your years that have been part of this team for you or been a champion for you that helps keep you going?
I've had many angel patrons or whatever you want to call them who've helped me, to get to the next level. There's a guy that I work with named Damien Guess, whom printed all the photographs for the first show I did in New Orleans 10 years ago with this company that he used to work at, run, or own, and he doesn't do that anymore. And now he's still on my team and helping me. You know, there's another guy named Chris Pizzolo in New York City who helps me. There's a guy named John Nichols who's on the team. So I've got some people around me that are great, and that, you know, you want to surround yourself with people who are great at what they do, and in turn you can all be great together.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
When you decided to go into this, was there any pushback from your family about how, like, you know, that's not a quote unquote practical job or anything like that, or were they supportive the whole way through?
Like I said earlier, I was trying to prove to my parents and my family, no, they were not supportive.
Mm-hmm.
No, they did not understand what I was doing. Yes, they did not send me to college to do that. They were not supportive of me, and they were just worried about me.
Right.
Being a rock and roll photographer is not a profession that's easily attained. You know, when you talk to a photographer, what do they want to do? I want to be a photographer for National Geographic or Rolling Stone. Well, my biggest dream in life was to be published in Rolling Stone, and it happened 30 times, and I was still broke.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, I need some new dreams.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like being a musician on the road or a photographer. A lot of folks who are less evolved, not to say that I'm more evolved, but in their career, you know, many people are trying to climb to the top of the same mountain. You get to the top of that mountain, you realize there's no view.
Hmm.
You need a new mountain.
Yeah.
So you just be careful what you ask for and what you manifest and think about, because you'll manifest the things you're thinking about.
Right.
So that's what I've, you know, over time, my parents became very proud of me. And, you know, I mean, shoot, they just did a CBS Sunday morning piece on me that was on national television. And some of my friends' grandmothers were telling them they saw me on TV, you know. And I had hired a publicist to help me with my new book. But she didn't give me that. Not that she couldn't, but I was out in the world and met a guy, and he was a producer for the show, and I told him about what I was doing, and then everyone was telling him about what they were doing, because obviously we're in a town full of creators, and they want to be on TV, and I gave him my books, and he saw them, and he goes, oh, wow, and he got it, and then he asked me to be on the thing. So I think being out in the world and being open to experience is what opens doors.
Yeah.
Just like how you and I met, like, you have a choice, and we chose to do this together today.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, when it just came about because I chose to talk to a girl, and then she chose to let me interview her, and then, you know, chose
to share. That's another
one.
So
yeah.
You were asking who's been with me for a long time, who Ellie Sanders, the woman who introduced the two of us, she's been with me off and on since 2003. And we don't work together on a day-to-day basis anymore, but she told you to call me. And that's what's really cool, the fact that we still, after everything she and I have been through over the years, still telling people to call me. And that makes me feel really good. And I know that my intention is good. My delivery has not always been so great. But as I'm getting older and hopefully wiser, my delivery is starting to change a little bit.
I'm kind of in that same boat. I kind of, you know, I know that my intentions are as pure as I can get them to be, and I know that there's love behind everything, but I have kind of like a
right.
heavy-handed, tough love medicine, you know, and not everybody is down for that. I kind of want to just kind of go back a little bit about how did you allow yourself to handle the fact that your family wasn't supportive or encouraging or understood what you were doing? How did you let that not affect you to keep going?
Well, my family wasn't supportive. People within the music business were not very nice to me, a lot of people. I took a photograph of Ray Charles in like 2000. It's painted on my wall upstairs in the studio. You probably saw it when you went up there. Some people told me that was one of the greatest music photographs they'd ever seen. And I was never really great at anything. Not to say I was even great at taking photographs, but that image is a great image. And I thought, well, that's what I'm going to do.
Okay.
And no one's going to stop me. And I'm going to become the best there ever was. You know, the things I told myself was like insane. But 27 years later, I'm still focused on music photography in a different way. But I'm still in that world, you know. So I just never gave up. I just never... And, you know, one day I had a really amazing job, and I called my father and I said, you ever make that much money in one day? And he said, no. And I go, well, I did. And for them, they wanted to hear about the dollars. You know, my mother, you know, who's passed away, I would tell her I was doing this photo shoot with someone, and she'd say, for money? And I'd say, no, but it's okay. It's all going to work out. And she'd be like, uh-huh.
Right.
It's like, but now all those photographs I did for free, you know, I'm selling artwork to collectors who collect my work, and, you know, I'm able to use these images to teach people who these musicians are, and it's really cool. It's a wonderful thing, and I feel super blessed that it's all kind of worked out. Everything I thought that would ever happen has happened, and I just want to keep moving forward and see where this whole thing will take me and my family and the people who are in my circle, you know?
Not to take you backwards when you just said you want to go forwards, but when was the first photo you took?
Like, first photo?
Yeah, the first time you had a camera in your hand and you...
I mean, I don't know. I used to take tons of pictures when I was a kid at summer camp. There's a photograph of me when I'm 13 years old on my bar mitzvah day, like taking a photograph of myself in a mirror with the camera.
A selfie.
Yeah, my original selfie for me. Yeah, it's exactly right. So I've always kind of had cameras in my hands.
Uh-huh.
And so thinking back, you know, when I was around 19, my dad gave me a professional camera. A Nikon 4004, which is on that shelf over there, and that I took some pictures of a Blues Traveler concert in 1995 at the Sunrise Amphitheater in Florida. Then I, moved to Colorado, and in '96 started photographing, you know, bands like Widespread Panic and Leftover Salmon and all these kind of jam bands, Colorado jam bands, and I was always into music. I was a big music guy, more than a photography guy, but I always had a camera, and I just stuck with it, man. I just never stopped taking photographs. I have so many photographs.
What's your favorite jam band?
I mean, I'm a Deadhead.
Grateful Dead.
I mean, I grew up as a Widespread Panic fan, but then, you know, I could talk to you about John McLaughlin and you know, I'm a Colonel Bruce Hampton fan and the Aquarium Rescue Unit. But through my journey as a music photographer, you know, I've been experienced. I lived in Colorado. It was more of a bluegrass kind of jam band, red rock bands playing at Red Rocks and the small clubs. And then going to New Orleans, all the funk music and, you know, the trad jazz. And I love all that. And then I moved to New York City and I got heavily into the jazz scene.
Okay.
Shooting a lot of, Newport jazz, Newport folk. I later went around, got hired to travel around the world going to, you know, Paris and, you know, Barcelona and Holland and shooting all these jazz festivals. And then I moved to Nashville and got more into Americana and all this. So basically all the different places I've lived, I've kind of infiltrated the music scenes in those towns and worked in those communities. But, I mean, I love the Grateful Dead. I love Widespread Panic. I love Phish. I love improvisational music. I love music, you know. John McLaughlin always said, you know, you want to leave blood on the floor. If you're taking a risk, like, I like to see the bands that are taking risks and I like to see where the music goes, and, you know, I get super turned on by that type of music.
Yeah. What has been your favorite venue to shoot at?
There's been many amazing venues. Like we said earlier, I was a house photographer at Red Rocks in the late 90s, early 2000s, and I love Red Rocks, obviously. Here in Nashville, I love the Ryman Auditorium. That's a cool place. When I was the house photographer for the Barcelona Jazz Festival, there's a place in Barcelona, is how you would say it, called the Palau de la Música, which is one of the most beautiful indoor venues in the world.
Okay.
I love that. There's so many different venues I love. And, you know, going back to concert photography and portrait photography, what we were talking about, they're two different beasts. You know, as a concert photographer, you're trying to capture something that's happening. As a portrait photographer, you're trying to create it, but by having the instincts to be able to capture something, you're able to capture what you're trying to create. So both skill sets work. So all those concerts I shot for a million years helped to train me to become the studio photographer that I would later become.
What are some of your favorite sessions where you think that you captured what you created best? Do any stick out as...
I was in Jamaica with Burning Spear, Winston Rodney in 2006. Amazing time. When I photographed Bootsy Collins in Cincinnati with all the rubber bands. He had a band called Bootsy's Rubber Band. When I went to Mickey Hart's house from the Grateful Dead, had an amazing experience. In 2008, there was a place called Weeksville in New York, which is the first free black settlement. And I'd been hired to do a project there where, you know, they had all these different places throughout this community where the first settlers would, you know, where they had the sewing machine, where they were in the garden, where they were in the kitchen. And so we brought people within their community, people like Delroy Lindo, the actor, and Jose James or Gene Gray or Pharaoh Monk or different people like that to come into the space and interact in the part of the house where... they would have been if they were alive in that time period.
Okay.
So we kind of did that. And I did all these awesome photos, and you know, they never ended up actually using those photographs. And this was 2008, so this has been, you know, 15 years ago. So these images have been sitting on my hard drive, and I was going to try to unearth them for Black History Month and start sharing all these photographs this past Black History Month, but I couldn't get it together. So maybe next year, my dream has been to show these photographs, and those were some of the images that I had a vision where I was trying to, you know, capture what I was creating, just like the Jam Cruise portrait project I was talking about, or when I was at the Cape Town. At the Cape Town Jazz Festival, I set up a portrait studio backstage, and I used the South African flag as the single prop in every single photo shoot. And so my dream was to shoot Hugh Masekela wrapped in the flag on his 70th birthday, which eventually happened as the last photo shoot I did after 3 days, but I also shot another 25 people with that flag leading up to that moment. So for me, again, it all goes back to telling stories with pictures, and I think that's what photography is about, is telling stories.
Yeah.
And that's my goal.
What do you do when you're not telling stories? What do you do when you're not at a music show? Do you have other hobbies and outlets and other ways that you're creating? Do you like paint secretly on the side? Do you have a short story that you're writing? Do you like to mow the yard? You know, like,
I mean,
what
I like to hang out with my daughter, and you know, I love doing exhibitions and building exhibitions. I love building the exhibits just as much as I love doing the photography. You know, to walk into a unique space, and I have my own walls that I traveled around with. So to walk in a unique space and envision how we can turn this space into kind of an immersive experience for people to take in, like that, building the exhibits and printing the photographs is just as much fun for me as taking the photographs.
So what can people look forward to in the future with your work?
Well, if you want to learn about my work, go to instrumenthead.com, and that'll take you to my website where you can get my books. I'm hopefully going to be on the road at more music festivals and things like that over the next year. And, you know, I'm going to keep trying to create and keep trying to put out my body of work and inspire people and inspire myself and my family and keep motivated and, you know, keep doing my thing.
You know, we didn't even mention it, that you had a whole live stream thing that you did here in your studio. Are you going to be doing more of those live streams, or just like live face-to-face performances?
Potentially. Well, yeah, we will have these live face-to-face performances in New Orleans at Jazz Fest. But yeah, I mean, the studio here in Nashville is prepared to do that. But I think now that the pandemic is over, you know, live streams were a necessity at the time because, you know, the whole world shut down.
Right.
And people who create need a space to create. And that was just a pivot that we did here. And if you go to Instrument Head Live on YouTube, you can actually see these concerts that we did. I mean, people like Victor Wooten, who I know you interviewed, you know, we did an Allman Brothers tribute with Peter Levin and Audley Freed and Jimbo Hart and Chad Gamble from Jason Isbell's band, along with Lamar Williams Jr. I mean, we did some amazing concerts in here. You know, I'm just kind of, you know, on the raft, and you're going down the river, and you see which way it takes you, and I think you're on a very similar path. And I'm open to doing everything and doing nothing at the same time, you know?
Well, I'm not going to take any more of your time, but if you've got any last words of wisdom for people out there, Now's the time to voice them.
I don't know. I think if you ride the bench long enough, eventually you're going to be a starter. Just be ready when it's your turn to play.
Hey, that's pretty good. Yeah. That's pretty good. Well, thanks so much, Michael, for your time and your story and everything that you're doing to help honor these musicians and the stories that they have.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Michael Weintraub is arguably one of the best-known music photographers out there, be it for his portraits or live performance work. Make sure to check out his website along with his Instrument Head and Instrument Head Revealed projects to get a better idea of the caliber of artists he's captured. You don't get to work with the people he has by being a "let me sit and think about this a little bit more"
type of person. You get to where he is by doing the thing you're good at and keeping at it, even if your parents don't get it. Thank you for being here to listen to episode 11 with Michael Weintraub of The Doers of Things. I just want to remind you of the value for value model this listening experience runs on. My current pledge to you is to never have sponsorship ads or corporate commercials. I also have no plans on creating tiered content or subscription fees that price people out of the experience of hearing their fellow humans share their stories. I want to keep all the content for all people all the time. I can do that with your help as a producer of the show via your time, talent, and treasure. I'm a one-woman operation over here, so if you enjoy the show, please consider becoming a producer to whatever level you can. Head on over to thedoersofthings.com in the Donate tab to learn more about how you can jump on board. Until the next time you tune in to The Doers of Things, I'm Mary Brett saying, be ready when the coach calls you off the bench.